Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is episode 206, Saturday Secret Wars Chronology. So this is part of our overall Marvel Chronology project. You know, Manny came into reading comics much, much later than I did. And so he's never read some of this classic stuff like the original Marvel superhero Secret Wars. And I myself have definitely fallen off the Marvel bandwagon, I guess you'd say, over the last 5 years or so. And I was trying to think of a way to get back into it. And I thought, you know what? There's this really, really great reading order put together by on a site called Comic Herald that goes into the original Secret Wars, you know, and all the little crossover comics that led into it, which that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the original Secret Wars, and then Secret Wars 2, and then into the Fantastic Four event that was kind of officially Secret Wars 3, and all the way leading into the latest Secret Wars that came out, I guess 2016 was, no, 2015, really? Has it been that long now? And then was supposed to finish in 2015, but bled over into 2016. So I thought it would just be a way to, remember? God, it's it's been that long, but yeah, it was supposed to be done in October because Marvel was doing another relaunch of everything, and I can't even remember for the life of me what that relaunch was called.
Was that Marvel Now?
No, it was before. It was not the second Marvel Now. It was whatever they called it, the relaunch after the first Marvel Now, but before the second Marvel Now. God, it's going to drive me crazy if I can't remember what it was called. I'm going to Google it real fast. But anyway, while I'm Googling that up. So, in order to get back into the swing of things, I thought, Secret Wars, that'll be a great way because it spans so much of the test of time, right? So that's why we're doing it. And for those not familiar, just a quick history of Secret Wars, and we'll talk about the impact that it had kind of at the end of this episode. But basically, Kenner Toys at the time had the license for the DC Comics characters, and they were putting out the DC characters, Superpowers set, you may have heard of it, or set of action figures, you may have heard of it. Mattel had He-Man, and that was selling really well. And Marvel and Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, thought that, you know, Marvel really had something to offer, and they should get these Marvel characters out as action figures and play sets and everything to, you know, kind of cash in on this new action figure craze. But Mattel only agreed to do it if there was a huge cosmic, all-encompassing kind of event, like a big, impactful event in the comics to tie in, right? And also through their infinite wisdom of marketing and testing and polls and whatever, they determined that the words secret and the word wars gathered the attention of kids. Like, kids would respond if something was called, had the word secret and wars in it. So ended up coming up with the title Marvel Superhero Secret Wars. And Mattel had a bunch of other notes, like, we got to make sure that Dr. Doom looks more advanced and not so medieval. We got to make sure that Spider-Man's costume gets updated. We got to make sure that Dr. Doom looks better. Iron Man looks better. Like, all these conditions they had, all these ideas, right? Because everybody knows when it comes to telling comic book stories, toy companies, they're the top notch, right? They have the best story ideas. And, you know, Marvel wasn't the juggernaut that it is now, so they weren't really in a position to say, we know better. We've been doing this for a long time. You know, it wasn't like that. This was back in the early 80s, and comics were still, at that time, kind of a boutique industry, right? I mean, they still are to some extent today. It's just that they've bled over into other industries like TV and movies where they're, you know, making lots of money for people. back then, that just wasn't the case. But because they had all these conditions, and because Jim Shooter was the one that was dealing with them, he decided, well, there's all these conditions, and I'm the one that's talking back and forth with them, so I'm really the only one who understands, and so I'm going to be the one to write it. So, you know, and all this took a long time, over months and months, but as it started to develop, and as Shooter started to get his story ideas, and came up with this idea of this kind of super-powered, all-powerful being called the Beyonder, he started seeding little clues and little ways that the Beyonder was affecting the Marvel Universe in the months leading up to the launch of Secret Wars, you know, before issue one came out. And so the first episode of Marvel Superheroes Chronology Project Secret Wars that we covered, we talked about Amazing Spider-Man 249, 250, and 251. And in those issues, we see that seemingly at random, for no reason whatsoever, Spider-Man's spider sense is going off, and he's in this like incredible amount of pain. And what we've come to understand is it's because the Beyond, that was when the Beyonder was scanning Earth, right? Because eventually what happens in the story is the Beyonder plucks all a big group of heroes and a big group of villains, and he brings them to a planet called Battle World, which is made up of little sections of a bunch of different planets from our galaxy all thrown together. Suburb of Denver, for example, is one of the areas of the planet. So the Beyonder throws this planet together, and he has like this battle, right? Like he wants to see what happens, heroes versus villains, because he's been observing our world and he wants to have a better understanding. So that's the basic premise of the story. So the issues we're going to talk about today, same kind of thing. It's, you know, they call it a prelude tie-in to the story. But I mean, honestly, if you want to get the whole story of Secret Wars, you really can kind of ignore these preludes because it's literally like a few panels in the story, at least from what I know, from what I've seen. I haven't read every single lead up to it, but we will this time because we're just trying to be thorough. But I also thought it would be a good opportunity for Manny to read some of these early to mid 80s Marvel stuff that he's never had a chance to read. So I think he enjoyed the Amazing Spider-Man stuff. The issues we're covering today, Uncanny X-Men 178 and 179 and New Mutants 13. I'll just tell you straight out, like pretty much the only impact or the only tie-in to Secret Wars is in all three of these issues we see at various times for a few panels. Professor Xavier seems to be in incredible pain and he senses that it's caused by some giant powerful being. And that's all we get, right? Obviously, as we know now, and as I was just saying, much like Peter Parker, Professor X is sensing this quote-unquote scanning from the Beyonder. So, as I said, you can go to comicbookherald.com and do a search for Secret Wars Chronology. He has it broken down into the complete chronology, which is what we're doing, covering everything that has anything to do with Secret Wars. Or you can read a more streamlined chronology, and that for the first Marvel Superhero Secret Wars is just the 12-issue miniseries, because it really, even though, you know, Mattel wanted it to be super impactful and, you know, change the Marvel Universe going forward, and Jim Shooter claimed that it would, it really didn't do much. And we'll talk about that when we get into the main issue itself. Main issues, I should say. So, yeah, if you want to go and check it out, as I said, comicbookherald.com and do a search for that. But let's get into the issues themselves. Maybe we'll start with New Mutants 13, which this is one that I hadn't read until until Manny and I decided to do this chronology. It was the first time I read it. So give me your initial thoughts on New Mutants 13, Manny.
Well, actually, this kind of goes for all three issues. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Kitty Pryde is a pretty prominent character throughout X-Men.
She was pretty popular at the time, yeah, because, you know, she was kind of the youngest member of the team and one of the newer members. So I think she was kind of like the point of view character for a lot of readers. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, because it seems like it, because we see a little bit of her in New Mutants, and then we see her again in Uncanny X-Men. Actually, this is okay. I'm not huge on X-Men, so yeah, I do enjoy the Spider-Man issues a little bit more, but it is cool to see New Mutants, just because we know that there's a film coming out this year, and like I got a little bit of a look at Cannonball and some of the other characters. That was interesting. It's a lot of, being that it's dated, of course, a lot of dialogue, and also being that we just kind of pick up in between. This is more for those few panels that have that tie into Secret Wars. It was kind of hard to get into what was going on, but it was an introduction to a character arriving at the school, so it made it a little bit easier.
What did you think of the art?
Dated, obviously. I tend not to judge as harshly when reading older books, just because I know they don't have necessarily maybe the same advantages as artists do now. But a lot of the facial expressions really just reminded me a lot of the current pop art. They use female faces for advertisements and things like that.
Yeah, and I guess we should go over the creative team real fast. So, Chris Claremont, writer, Sal Buscema, legendary penciler. Tom Mandrake did the inks, and Tom Orzechowski, hope I pronounced that right, the letterers. So, you say it's wordy, and that is, somewhat a product of its time. You know, comics back in the 80s had a lot more dialogue boxes, a lot more exposition. And so back then, the old guard of writers kind of always assumed that there were new readers on every single issue they wrote, right? So when you're reading it in the dialogue, you'll notice early on in the first few pages, whenever people are talking, they're always calling other characters by name, right? Because if you're not familiar with the characters, if it's the first time you're picking up the book, you kind of need to know who everybody is. So you'll notice that there's a lot more of people calling each other by name throughout the book than you would see in a title these days. The other thing, as Manny mentioned, is that, yeah, the art's not quite as before I move on from Chris Claremont as a writer, there's more dialogue and more exposition and dialogue boxes and such because it's an older book and a little bit of its time. But also, when you talk about being of its time, Chris Claremont was one of the most wordy writers of them all. I mean, people even complained about it back then, about, man, this guy just, sometimes it's just pages and pages of text. Look at some of those old X-Men comics. What's amazing, John Byrne art, and so much of it's covered up because, you'll have a panel that's got like, four word balloons in it, and it's, an eighth of a page panel, or a ninth of a page panel. So, yeah, Claremont is like super, super wordy. I'm looking at page 2 right now of New Mutants number 13, and you look at it, and it's just like, man, so many words. Every panel first panel has 4, next one has 3, 3. 4, 3, 3. I mean, that's a lot of word balloons. Even for that time, Claremont super wordy. To talk a little bit about Sal Buscema on the pencils. So yeah, the art, I mean, he's a legendary guy. Great storytelling from panel to panel. Very well respected. And he's great at rendering most of the time, but yeah, it's not quite as polished, especially in some of the panels where there are a lot of characters, and the panels tend to be, a little smaller in these older books because they used to, that was just the style of storytelling. They used more panels and a lot of smaller panels and not so many splash pages. And when you think about that in a way it takes longer because you have more panels, and the way they would still stay on schedule is that the detail is not, as fine as you would see a detail in a comic today. Also, another thing to consider is a lot of these artists were doing multiple books, and there was no, I'm late, I missed my deadline. I mean, very happened once in a while, but most of the time it was like, if you missed your deadline, you didn't get paid. you know, and these guys were making, you know, less money back then, even, you know, taking into account inflation. So this is a perfect example because it's Sal Buscema. I know exactly what other title he was working on during this time. This book came out. When did it come out? Let me do a quick search. But the other title he was working on was ROM Space Knight, which is one of my favorites. Let's see, New Mutants Volume 1, number 13, came out in March 1984. So yeah, definitely ROM Space Knight. So you can kind of understand, and I'll give him a pass on the art not being quite as polished. Oh, and Manny, the initiative that came out of Marvel's the Secret Wars event in 2015 was the all-new, all-different Marvel.
Oh, God, no, don't. All-new, all-different.
All-different with the same creators and the same characters and with nothing really changed.
You mean kind of like Legacy?
Exactly, like Legacy. And don't forget that even though it's supposed to start in October and we're going to launch Iron Man and give away the ending to Secret Wars, Secret Wars is not actually going to end until, like, what was it, February or March? Yeah,
something like that.
Anyway, not to go down that treacherous path.
A rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, as Manny said, the New Mutants 13, Magma's being introduced, who ends up being a pretty important member of the team, kind of one of the linchpins of the New Mutants for quite a while. And in this issue, you know, she's being introduced to the team. They brought her over from Italy, and the kind of, I don't want to say fantasy world, but she kind of lived in a, like, kind of a pocket city that was kind of like hidden, and it was still, you know, back in much more like a medieval times, and she was a princess, and she had earth powers, and so that's why her name was Magma. She could, like, summon lava from the ground and this and that. So the story is of its time, but it's good characterization. I mean, Chris Claremont is one of the best as far as characterization and interactions, and does a great job when it's a big cast of characters like the New Mutants are. As I mentioned before, the only real tie-in to Secret Wars is Professor Xavier sensing, you know, some kind of scan that kind of scrambles his mind. I mean, it's literally two panels when he's kind of sitting in his library thinking, and all of a sudden he just says, ow, scanning wave again, came from nowhere, all of a sudden disappeared as suddenly as it arrived, contacts more intense and painful, no closer to learning its origin. He should devote energy to solving the mystery, but if he does, who's going to look after his students? His obligations bind him there, and that's what he needs to focus on. And that's it. It's literally two panels. So like I said, it's easily skipped, but the New Mutants, I never read it back in the day. It just, I don't know, it never appealed to me. You know, I did enjoy the X-Men stories back then, but for whatever reason, I just didn't care for the New Mutants title. So, but there are a lot of people who swear by it. You know, it is Chris Claremont, and he is a known for this. It's classic 80s Marvel comics, and as Manny said, there is a, is it a movie or a TV show that's coming out? Movie, right?
Yeah, it's like a horror flick that they're making.
That'll be interesting, because there's a lot of New Mutant fans out there. You know, they were pretty popular back in the day, so there may be some traditionalists out there that are gonna hate it. But if you want to pick it up, you can find it in trade relatively cheaply, or if you have the Marvel Unlimited subscription, I'm sure you can read it there. I'm sure all the issues of New Mutants Volume 1 are available, and it may be available on Comixology as well. If so, it's such older material, they're probably all available in there for 99 cents. All right, let's move on to Uncanny X-Men 178. Again, written by Chris Claremont. Come on, trying to get my pad to work here so I can give you the creative lineup. Yep, so written by Chris Claremont. The pencils are by John Romita Jr. We have Bob Wyachek and Brett Breeding on inks. Glennis Wine on colors. and Tom Orzechowski on letters. So, first thing I'll say, John Romita Jr. art, but when you look at it, it very much does not look like the art that he puts out these days. I mean, for somebody like me who's pretty versed in comic art, I can recognize this as John Romita Jr. art, and I can recognize his current work as John Romita Jr. art. I vastly prefer this art. The rendering's just more clean. It's not as stylized. It's not as blocky. But you can definitely see, like, if you were to go back and look at his first work, which I think was in 79 or 80, on Iron Man, and then look at this from 1984, and then look at his work now, you definitely would see a progression. You would see that change in style. I think with this style, where, you know, he's kind of starting down the path of going, you know, a little blocky, and not as sharp with his rendering, with this style, where he is still has a little softer line, has a little cleaner look, it's easier to see the skill of his storytelling from panel to panel. I think with his style now, where he uses bigger, blockier characters, he loses some of the panel layout skill. Like, it's not as readily apparent that he's really great at layouts within panels themselves. And the storytelling from panel to panel and his choices, as far as your view in the panel, are very different. He, you know, because of his style, because it's gotten so blocky, he tends to, from a perspective point of view, be further away from the characters now. Because if he were to draw in the same style that he draws now and be zoomed in and close up, it'd be much harder to tell what it is you're looking at. Whereas, for example, there's a panel in this book, and it's actually the panel right before he senses the Beyonder's scan, where it's you see Rogue in the background, kind of a bookcase in the background, and then all you see is Professor Xavier from, like, the bridge of his nose down to, like, the top of his shoulders. But you can clearly tell who it is. You can clearly tell what you're looking at, and it's a cool layout. It's a cool kind of cinematic look. I don't think you could get that now with his. It would look horrible with his current style of work. So, as I said, I vastly prefer this over his current style. But even this is starting to get, it's not as clean. I don't enjoy it as much as his first couple years of books. As far as the story itself, it's a pretty good X-Men story. Basically, in issue 172 was when Rogue joined the X-Men. She previously had been a member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, and, you know, Rogue's power, for those not familiar, she can absorb other people's powers and emotions and feelings and memories by touching them. So she always has to constantly wear gloves, and she's in a fight with the Avengers at one point, and she touches Carol Danvers, Miss Marvel. And the longer Rogue stays in contact with somebody, the more memories and the longer, she can steal their powers for. She ends up staying in contact with Carol Danvers, Miss Marvel, at the time that she steals all her powers and completely. And that's how she got the ability to fly and her super strength and invulnerability and all that stuff. But she also was living with the memories and the thoughts of Carol Danvers. And she goes to Professor Xavier for help and agrees to kind of repent from her evil ways. Cause she just can't deal with the fact that, she has these powers and these memories and these feelings of some other person. So that's X-Men 172. 178, the villains or the antagonists of the story are that same Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. So Mystique had always considered Rogue as kind of an adopted daughter and was not aware that Rogue was there with the X-Men of her own free will. So she thinks that she's launching a rescue mission. And so Nightcrawler's out on a date with a lady friend and decides that she needs a distraction to keep them where they are. And so she sends her Brotherhood of Evil Mutants to Manhattan to kind of ambush Nightcrawler Meanwhile, Colossus has been, he's in his metal form, but he's frozen. And so with all these cuts on him and everything, and, you know, heated and then frozen, and if he changes back, he's going to crack and die. And so Kitty's dealing with that, and she decides she's going to go to the Baxter building to try to get some help from Reed Richards, because at this point, you know, she's still in love with Colossus, and they're still kind of a couple. So you have that going on, and while all that's going on, Professor Xavier is pretty much left alone in the mansion with a Rogue. And so then Mystique attacks, or undertakes what she thinks is going to be a rescue mission, to get Rogue back, basically. But Rogue convinces her in the end to let her be, and she wants to stay there. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. As I said, it's a lot of moving pieces. It's a lot of dialogue because it's Chris Claremont. And as far as it ties into Secret Wars, it's just those three or four panels where, again, Professor Xavier is sensing the scanning of the Beyonder. I'm interested to hear your take, man. I know you're not a huge fan of X-Men, and I think this is probably the first X-Men comic from this era that you've read. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. The first page really actually drew me in, because Colossus is one of the cooler X-Men, in my opinion. So, to see him in the state that he's in, it did pique my interest. And throughout the book, I thought this was really, really well done. Storytelling with the Brotherhood and how it happened, I kind of wanted to go back and maybe read a couple of issues. Backtrack and get a little bit more of the story. It's a pretty well done story. And then I knew that the whole John Romita Jr. thing was going to come up, because it just makes me think, like, why can't you draw like this now? Like, at least draw like this, because this would have been nice on All Star Batman, not the terrible,
right? It just
blocky thing that we got.
Right, I mean, his style and character has gotten so blocky that I think the best way to describe it is his storytelling has lost some fluidity. It seems much more choppy now. Yeah,
because it's really distracting. But, like, he has great facial expressions that convey really, really great emotion, and the movement on panel to panel, like, it just plays really, really well. I especially like the way he draws the blob. I don't know why. He's always been one of those obscure villains that I like, just because he's the blob. So that was pretty cool. Overall, it was really good. It was, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed how he drew, Professor Xavier, because a lot of the times, when you see Professor Xavier, he's kind of like talking to himself or talking telepathically. So, you can see it in his face, like the pressure he's under, or just how hard he's in this thought process, and you can really see that. I think that's really well done. I did notice that panel that you were talking about, where you can kind of see like half of his face, and you can see Rogue. So for being my first X-Men comic of this era, this was pretty cool. Again, that's why I asked about Kitty Pryde, because it seems to be that she's pretty prominent in this book as well.
What Claremont used to do back then was he gave, as far as just the kind of individual character arcs of the X-Men, he would kind of, you know, for Spotlight one for a few issues, and then they would kind of, you know, recede to the background, and they'd bring somebody else kind of to the fore. So it just so happens that these issues are kind of when Kitty's on an upswing, because there's other issues where he's much more focused on Storm or Wolverine. So not every issue from this era would see Kitty be so prominent, but it was just kind of her turn. But I completely agree with you about the rendering of Romita here. I mean, his style now, he could never do things like, you know, have that sharpness on the eyebrow, you know, around the eyes and whatever, like I was saying. It just wouldn't work. His style just wouldn't suit those kind of a panel layouts. But I agree. I mean, you can really see that the professor is concentrating in a lot of the panels. And I think one of my favorite panels from the book actually is also the blob. And it's the one where it's kind of zoomed in on it. I mean, literally all you see is his eyes and kind of his ears. And part of his nose, and a lot of it is because he's like backlit, so his face is kind of shaded in darkness, and it's like a beautifully drawn panel, and nearly unrecognizable as John Romita Jr. if you were to look at his work today, and it's the page where Wolverine's holding his fist under the Blob's chin in the first panel, and then you look down. And
I know exactly what you mean. I know the detail underneath, like you said, underneath the eyes.
Yep.
Just kind of the crow marks he puts on the side of his face. And also, I mean, the coloring of the eyes really, really helped too.
Yep.
But yeah, definitely not the, I would love to see a modern day Romita version of this today. That'd be really interesting.
It's interesting that you mentioned colors as well, because the colors in this are done really well, but at the same time there are certain places where you can tell it's just off. There's one panel where Storm, for example, has green, looks like she has green lipstick on, and that's just, again,
that's the same page.
It's just a product of its time. You know, the paper quality wasn't as good back then. It was a completely different coloring process. So when you do get panels like the one where the Blob's eyes are zoomed in on, and it's blue with the shading and the brown hair, you appreciate it that much more because it looks so great. All right, let's move on to issue 179, which, again, as Manny said, it really is Kitty's the star. And this flows right out of the previous issue. So it stars the Morlocks as the antagonist, and Storm had defeated the previous leader of the Morlocks and agreed to kind of be their leader. But really, she was leader in name only. She never really fulfilled any of her duties or tried to kind of lead them. As I said, it was just a name only. But there was a situation where Kitty had to agree to marry the Morlock Caliban, who his powers, he's got super strength, and he's pretty impervious to harm, but he looks like an albino, and he's really kind of slow. He's kind of simple. And so Kitty had agreed at one point to gain the Morlock's help to rescue the X-Men, that she would marry Caliban. And basically in this issue, the Morlocks are calling Kitty on that and saying, hey, you agreed to marry him because we helped you and you shirked your responsibility and it's time to pay up. And really, Callisto, the former member of the Morlocks, she's kind of pushing this. She's kind of pushing Caliban to call Kitty out on this as a way to get revenge against Storm, who defeated her in combat to become leader of the Morlocks, because Storm and Kitty have a very, very close relationship. Storm sees herself almost as a mother or a big sister to Kitty. And so it's not that Callista really cares about Kitty keeping her promises. She's just doing it to hurt Storm, basically. Oh, and I should say once again, Chris Claremont is the writer. John Romita Jr. Is joined by Dan Green. They're just both listed as artists, so I imagine maybe because the art in this issue looks even a little less polished than the previous issue, I have a feeling that there are pages where Romita just kind of did a rough sketch, like the opening splash page, and Green did, you know, what we call finishes, so much more of detail work rather than just going over Romita's lines with inks. And Green handled the coloring as well. And then we have Tom Orzechowski on letters again. So still the same amount of dialogue, still the same exposition. But there are a couple of really cool X-Men moments in here. Wolverine has a really cool one in the morgue. Because in order to kind of hide the fact that they've kidnapped Kitty, you know, knowing the X-Men are going to figure it out, but to give them time to kind of set up what they need to do. One of the Morlocks who has the ability to kind of melt flesh, they basically find a deceased homeless person in the, and this happened actually in the previous issue, and she uses her abilities to manipulate, facial features to make this, corpse look like Kitty Pryde. And so the X-Men are called to the morgue and they, you know, go to examine the, identify the body as Kitty and it looks like her, and they're, you know, start to get all sad, and Wolverine's all, nope, ain't her, sense wrong. And just so nonchalant about it. It's really cool. And then the other, cool scene, so eventually, you know, not to spoil a comic that's 30 years old, whatever, the X-Men realize what's wrong. They go to rescue Kitty. Kitty says, nope, she had tried to run away, but then realized that she kind of had to face the music and live up to her agreement. And she, part of the reason she also agrees to it is the Morlocks have a healer. And as I mentioned, and Manny mentioned, in the splash page of the last issue, we see that Colossus has all these cuts on his body, but he's in his steel form, but he's frozen. And even if he were conscious, and he's kind of in a coma, state, but even if he were conscious and he were to switch back to his flesh and blood state, he'd immediately bleed out and die because he has all these cuts. So Kitty agrees to keep her word, marry Caliban, and also in exchange for that, the Morlocks are going to have their healer help with Colossus's injuries. So at the moment of him changing back to the human form, the healer will lay hands on him and heal the cuts. Rogue also has a really cool moment in the story where she touches Colossus when he's in the state to try to kind of pass on some of her strength and invulnerability to him while he switches from one form to the other. So that's another really cool moment. And then in the end, Caliban shows that he really does have a heart of gold, and he releases Kitty from her obligation to marry him because he knows that she doesn't really love him the way that Caliban loves Kitty. And again, it goes back to kind of the simpleness of his mind and everything. And so all's well that ends well for now for the X-Men. But of course, you know, that doesn't last long with Chris Claremont at the helm. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. Again, as far as it tying into Secret Wars, it's like one panel, again, two panels maybe, where Professor's Xavier's telepathically communicating with Storm, and then all of a sudden he's overwhelmed by, it says, a massive, irresistible blast of psychic energy. And he's like, scanning wave of extraterrestrial origin, encountered it before, unable to pinpoint its source, blah, blah, blah. So again, the tie into Secret Wars is minimal, but the story is pretty cool. So what were your thoughts on this issue, Manny?
Liked it a lot less than the previous issue.
Yeah, it's a lot less action.
I'm not really that too, but I'm just not a fan of stories with like underground societies, like mole people, like things like that. So I don't know. It's just not my cup of tea. And also, there's such a difference in art from last issue and this one. I feel that just throughout the issue in general, it just felt rushed. It's definitely a step down from 78. So. A little bit of a letdown. I don't see it as much. I don't see the same level of art as from the previous issue. Granted, it looks like you have a lot more to work on here with so many people underground. But still, just, not as polished. But I do like the couple of panels where Kitty, she kind of steps up and realizes that, you know, she needs to do what's right. And that's an important piece of her character to include. So kudos on that. And, the solution to, Colossus's problem, that was done well. One of the cool moments with Wolverine, you know, him sniffing it out, and then waiting to making sure that the doctor's out of the room so that only they can kind of, know what's really going on. So, it's written really well. But a little bit of a step down.
Yeah, the art, you know, I'm flipping through the pages right now and I'm looking at them like, a big part of the reason the art, I think, doesn't look as finished is there's very few backgrounds. There's a lot of just blank backgrounds. We see the characters, we see the ground, and that's it. There's no backgrounds at all. So yeah, I think, I'm not sure what else Romita had going on this month. If he was working on something else, or I mean, for all we know, he could have been sick. So yeah, it's clear that Dan Green gave him a lot of help. Some pages more than others, because there are some pages where, like that page in the morgue, where there is a lot of detail. Still don't have a whole heck of a lot of background, but it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Romita drew that page, at least the majority of that page by himself, without much help from Green, whereas other pages, like the splash page or the page where, I think her name is it Mask, the woman who can alter skin, where she's changing Kitty to look like one thing or another, you know, giving her Callisto's face or Caliban's face or whatever. I mean, you can tell that it's just not the same level of art, as you mentioned. So, still a good story. It's still, you know, Romita's run on X-Men, you know, starts with, you know, the new X-Men, issue 94. Well, Giant Size X-Men and then 94. And all the way up into the 200s when Silvestri takes over on art is really, really cool. And some people would say his whole entire run is worth reading. You know, eventually you get the Jim Lee art and the blue and gold team. So, yeah, I have plenty of trades, Manny, if you ever want to get caught up on the Claremont era of X-Men. It lasted quite a long time.
Right, oh gosh, so I have so much to catch up on.
I know, right? Not enough hours of the day to read all the comics we want to read. Too bad.
Yeah, our first Christmas, it was like, Merry Christmas. Kill the entire crisis. Have fun.
Yeah, exactly. I did kind of throw you into the deep end there. So those are the three issues we're going to cover in this episode. And just one other thing that I want to talk about for a little bit in this episode is kind of the impact of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars on the comic industry overall. I wonder if you remember, Manny, at what point did you become aware of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars as a comic event? Can you even?
I don't remember exactly when I recognized it as, you know, as a major event. I knew it was very important just because of how popular and prominent that cover is with Spider-Man in the Venom suit.
Got it.
So I've always known that it was important. I just didn't know the reason why. I didn't know what implications it had. So something that I'm learning now through. The different sites, and then also through Dexter now, just going through and reading it ourselves.
Did you remember any of the toys at all? I'm not sure how long they've lasted. I don't seem like they didn't. They, I mean, compared to the superpowers toys, they really weren't. The sculpting wasn't as good. They didn't have as, you know, articulation wasn't as good. They really weren't very high quality figures compared to the DC Superpowers line, and that line lasted a lot longer, had a lot more waves. I think Secret Wars just had two waves, and they weren't really around that long.
No, I don't remember the toys at all.
Okay, fair enough. As far as impact on the industry, so this is really what I wanted to get at. If you're one of those people that really dislikes the big mega event crossovers where you got to buy, like, you know, every title to get the complete story because it's, you know, tying in loosely to whatever's going on, then you should hate Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, because this is the beginning of it. This was the beginning of the giant limited series that involves a bunch of heroes, and, you know, it just kept growing by leaps and bounds. Because this did sell so well. But what's interesting is, so, as I mentioned before, if you look at, like, Amazing Spider-Man 251, for example, where Spider-Man finds this alien-looking device, big, huge, round ring device in Central Park, walks into it, and then disappears, we now know that's how the Beyonder transported him to Battleworld. But the very next issue, 252, he returns, right? And so the entire 12-issue Marvel Superhero Secret Wars takes place between those two issues. Except that the Amazing Spider-Man title didn't go on hiatus for 12 months, right? It just picked up from where it left off the previous issue, and everything got filled in later on. So, you know, Marvel wasn't about to suspend everything, and they weren't. I mean, nowadays, if you do it, or if you look at what they did with the Secret Wars event in 2015 that Manny and I were disparaging a little bit earlier, they did halt all their regular titles and relaunched all their regular titles as limited series that were taking place on the new Battle World. And then restarted the series back up as all new, all different Marvel, like we talked about. So a much different take. But back then, there was no such thing as a big, giant, mega crossover. So they were kind of, you know, inventing it as they went along. And they felt the best way to do it, to have the least impact on the creative teams for the regular titles, was just to have the characters disappear at the end of one book, at one issue, and then reappear at the beginning of the next issue, with sometimes some subtle hints about some things that happened, whatever. And if you wanted to know why some things changed, if you wanted to know, for example, why Spider-Man had a black costume now instead of the classic red and blue, well, you got to go read the miniseries to find out, or maxi series, I guess you call it, being that it was 12 issues. So as far as impact on the industry, it sold like gangbusters. So it kind of woke everybody up, right? And everybody decided, whoa, well, you know, and in fairness to DC, they already had planned their own kind of big crossover. There was a, you know, Crisis on Infinite Earths had been planned. You know, it took a couple years to come together as a way to clean up their history. But I'm sure that the sales on Marvel Superhero Secret Wars gave them confidence that Crisis was going to work. So, because Crisis started later that same year in 84, I think, maybe November or December, or maybe even a little earlier than that. But anyway, the success of Crisis as a 12-issue maxi series, the success of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, really kind of set the tone for a long, long time that, hey, we're going to get these giant mega crossovers, and they just started growing from there. Marvel Superhero Secret Wars number 2, or not number 2, but Marvel Superhero Secret Wars 2, the sequel to this, which was Marvel did the following year, was only 8 issues, except it was set on Earth, and so it was much easier to cross over with the regular titles. So when you look at the number of issues, like, as I said, you can go to comicbookherald.com and you can, you know, look at the complete list and read all the little, read the comics that have the little tie-ins leading up to it, like the ones that we talked about on this episode. But if you really want to get the main story, all you need to do is read issues 1 through 12 of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars. For Secret Wars 2, there are some pretty important events that happen in other comics. You have to act, even though it was only 8 issues, if you want the complete story, you got to buy a heck of a lot more comics than just 12. Because it crossed over with a lot of the regular titles. In the corner of their monthly books, they would kind of put a diagonal slash, so you had a little triangle in the corner, and it would say Secret Wars 2 tie-in or Secret Wars 2 crossover. So, you know, issues of Avengers, issues of Thor, issues of Rom Space Knight, issues of Spider-Man, issues of X-Men. If you wanted the complete story, man, you were buying the entire Marvel line along with these. And it wasn't for the entire 8 months that Secret Wars 2 came out. You know, each month you'd have maybe 2 to 4 different Marvel titles that would tie into Secret Wars. But in the end, you end up with, you're like, have like, you know, 30 books. And so it really was a way to boost sales. And it only grew from there. You know, Crisis was kind of the same way as Marvel's Superhero Secret Wars 2, as far as it crossed over with a few different titles each month. But man, you look at some of the events now, and you're looking at like 50 books, and there's one-shot tie-ins, and there's mini-series tie-ins, and it's, man, they just go all in trying to grab that the dollars out of the pocket. So it can all be traced back to the success of Marvel's Superhero Secret Wars, for good or bad. So in that way, it really had an incredible impact on the industry. You have anything to add to that, Manny?
I think now that you mention it, having doing those books that way is probably the best way to go. You don't lose momentum on your individual books, and then you are able to still have your event. Almost kind of like DC is doing it now with the Watchmen series and with Metal. I mean, it's not interrupting all the other books, which is great. Meanwhile, Marvel, they halted everything, and because of that, that's twice now where books are coming out before they should, and it's kind of putting everything, just making them look really, really bad over and over again.
Spoiling their own story.
And then what makes it worse is I really think that using Secret Wars 2, bringing that title, does the classic series a disservice because of, you know, how important it is in comic lore, and they kind of taint it with an opportunity to cash in on something that's historically great, and then at the same time reboot so that you can cash in again. And they did the same thing with Civil War. Some of the great moments from the first Civil War, like Peter Parker revealing his identity and you know, really separating the Marvel universe, you know, heroes done for a long time, now on opposite end, and then you're gonna paint it by doing something as terrible as Civil War 2 to boost your sales because of the, and use it for the film. The film has nothing to do partially with Civil War, but they still named it that. And then what do? You reboot again because you're trying to get the money. It's really sad to see that kind of the place that Marvel's getting to or has gotten to the past few years, especially with as much rich history as they have. And I'm getting a glimpse of that day in and day out as we read these classic titles with names like Claremont and early Romita art, and I mean just Gary Conway and like all these other people who did a fantastic job at really making the foundation for these new editors and new executives to screw up.
Yeah, it is kind of sad in a way, and I wonder if Marvel realizes. I mean, you say, you know, it's gotten bad in the past couple of years, and that's completely true. But at the same time, I almost feel like they've already jumped the shark. Like, it's to the point now, their sales were so bad last year that they even have to realize that they have completely exhausted that well. Like, they no longer can reboot and get a boost from the fact that one of their titles has a number one on the cover. Like, they, you know, I started saying it 5 years ago. They can't keep rebooting it and getting these, boosts, because it's just the nature of publishing comics. The way it goes is, you know, your first issue has the highest sale numbers, and then you have an attrition over time from sales. And so the way to get it, you know, back up, and it has a lot to do with the collector mentality or the completist mentality a lot of comic readers have. They want to have the whole run, right? They want to have the whole story, you know, from issue one to whatever. And it's, again, it's part of the fact that comics are collectibles. And so that was why you used to get the bumps. And Marvel took advantage of that. And they said, you know, we're just going to start with a new number one, start with a new number one, start with a new number one. And each time with the, you know, that little bit of an artificial sales bump and, you know, got to be less and less over time, to the point where now it doesn't, I don't think having a number one issue even moves the needle for Marvel at all now. So in a way, it's kind of sad, but hopefully they're going to be turning around. But because, as I said, I think they finally realize that they drained that well dry. There's no more sales to be had just because it's a number one. So almost the exact opposite of the impact of Secret Wars, showed them a way they could get more sales. I think the rebooting of Constant Number Ones has showed them the way they can alienate readers and lose sales. So, hope you're listening, Marvel. All right, anything else to add on Secret Wars, Manny?
What a long way to go.
Yeah, once we start getting into the issues themselves, though, I have a feeling that we're going to devour them pretty quick. Maybe we'll even do more than one a week. We'll see. All right, everybody.
Cool.
I want to thank you all for joining us on the Comic Source Podcast. Don't forget, you can go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter. Just do a search for The Comic Source. Also, if you search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram, that's the best way to keep up to date when we're releasing new content and convention coverage. Also, we still have our exclusive podcast for the 9-Panel Grid that comes out on Tuesdays. Our exclusive podcast with LRM Online, called the 9-Panel Grid, that's released on Tuesdays, aimed more toward the beginning comic reader. Now, we still have plans to get all our content from the comicsourceblog.com moved over to LRM, so we'll definitely keep you up to date on that status. So thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.